Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Now, in the book of Revelations, we find I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed will they be who wash their robes, that they may have the right to approach the tree of life and may enter the city by the gates. Come, say the Spirit and the Bride. Let him who hears say, come. Let him who thirsts come. Let him who will take the water of life freely. We human beings, so-called persons, we have lived with myths since time immemorial. Myths that were handed down through tribes by word of mouth. You know, folk tales, we call them sometimes now. You know, and the myths that we now have in books that we can read about. Now, a myth is rather like a parable, and a parable is something that stands side by side and points to something that is hidden, something that cannot really be described, such as we have the simple myth of Sisyphus and the rock, you know. Lots of them, huh? A myth is a story of an event which we are to take within ourselves, let it ferment, as it were, and in its brewing, it transforms. It changes some of the conditions in the psyche. It's something like, you know, we have a koan, this problem that we have, that we use, that we observe, you know, we take it in. You know, before your mother and father, you know, what was your original face? You take it in, you know, you ingest it, as it were, you eat it, and you allow it to settle in, you digest it, and it does its work. That is, if you do your part. And we have, you know, the creation myth, Genesis, which we borrowed from very ancient of times. And we have the Christmas myth. The actuality of Christmas, we can only surmise until a transformation within ourselves has come about and we perceive and experience this innocent babe. Then it is no longer a myth. It has become actual. Yeah. And so today we come together with a great majority of the Western culture to celebrate Easter, the myth of Easter. There's something hidden here. It is the crucifixion and the resurrection, Easter. Which we are also to actualize. To many in the Eastern culture, the Western culture, the most important celebration of the year is Easter, because it deals with life after death, or so it is usually understood. It's, in a way, too bad that it is not more deeply penetrated, toward its actuality, that it has been kept mainly for a childhood mind. You know, they talk about rabbits and chickens and eggs, and it almost sounds like more like procreation than it does resurrection. What about this resurrection? And here and there, we find those who are not satisfied with the answers that are readily supplied to them, who want to know more, who want to experience deeply the actuality of their own lives. Now, wherever you seek, whatever you seek, no matter what the label, deep within, behind the facades, behind the masks, whatever you are seeking is motivated by a search for yourself. Basically, fundamentally, we want to know ourselves. See? Not just a myth about ourselves. Not knowing this is our basic, fundamental state, not knowing this, we have construed all manner of things, to seek. Some seek for wealth because they're looking for more life. They want life more abundant, they say. And they're looking for a monetary security. They're looking for security. It's almost as if there's a little something in us that says, without money, how will I protect myself against death? And another person may seek prestige, power, to be so powerful that death can't come near him. There are those on attaining the position of power, realize the poverty. Blessed are the poor, for they shall enter the kingdom. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to go around in rags and tatters, but what does it really mean, this poverty? Monks the world over, in every tradition, they take the vow of poverty. Why? Well, one reason is that in time they hope to understand the adage that the Son of Man hath nowhere to lay his head. Poverty. So our search for things hides a search for a deathless existence. And the deathless existence, that possibility, exists within you. Now, just let us learn to look correctly. That which is within you, your deathless possibility, you can't touch with your hands. You can't walk toward it because legs walk that way, out. Legs don't travel inwardly. Your eyes move out. Your ears move out. Your sense of touch moves out. But there is something in us that moves inwardly. And properly used, moving inwardly is the way to the great transformation. And Jesus said, if you bring forth that within yourselves, that which you have will save you. Now, within you now. Sometimes this is spoken of as the seed of the divine. We've all heard this expression, a seed of the divine. See, the God seed. You know, using Meister Eckhart's terminology, you know, pear trees come from pear trees, pear seeds. Apple trees come from apple seeds. And there are God seeds. Don't ignore it. In ignoring it, that which you do not have, he said, will kill you. So, in this body, somewhere, somehow, a seed. What are you doing about it? What does one do with a seed? You put it in the ground. You put it in the soil. And then we say, there you let it die. It dies in the ground. And in its dying, it is transformed. And out of the transformation, the tree rises. And we left the Garden of Eden, knowing the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and we are to go back and know the tree of life. And the tree is in the seed. As that which we call I am is in the God seed. Just waiting. You know, I read a story once about a king. And he was very puzzled. He had a problem. He had three sons. And they were very strong, talented men, young men. And it was very difficult for this father to decide to whom he should give his kingdom. Yeah. And he was getting along in years. The boys were pretty grown. And not being able to solve his problem, he went to a wise man in his kingdom and asked him what to do. And this wise man devised a plan. And he said to the king, you go on a pilgrimage. And following this plan then, the king called his three sons to him and gave them each the same quantity of seeds, of very rare, beautiful flowers. And he told them, preserve these seeds as carefully as possible, because your whole future depends upon them. Now, your whole future depends upon them, the seed. And when I come back from my pilgrimage, you will have to give me a report of what happened to the seeds. At the end of your life, what are you going to say? I did this with my seed. Anyway, the king went away. Now, the eldest son was rather clever, and he was kind of cunning and calculating, like, you know. And he thought to himself, well, the best way to preserve these seeds will be to lock them away in a safe. And when my father returns, you know, he'll ask for them, and I'll just take them out of the safe. Exactly as he has given, I will return. So he took care to find the best of all safes and locked away the seeds, carrying with him the key 24 hours a day. You lose the key. And the second son thought, the seeds have to be preserved. But if I lock them up like my elder brother, they could rot. And my father will say to me, now they're useless. So what to do? So he went to the marketplace and he sold the seeds. And he said, this is the best way. Sell the seeds, keep the money, and when my father returns, I will repurchase seeds. And who's going to know the difference? Seeds are seeds. The new seeds I will give to my father, and they will be fresh and alive, not rotten. So he sold them, and he kept the money. And the third son thought to himself, well, now seeds have been given. There must be some significance in this. The youngest he was, you know, and a little innocent still. And he thought to himself, now seeds are meant to grow. The very word seed means growth. And growth is not a goal, it's a bridge. It means reaching towards something. A seed in itself is meaningless until it grows, unless it becomes what it was meant to be. A seed is a beginning phase. It's not a final state. So he went into the garden and he planted the seeds. And then after a year, the father returned. And he asked his sons about the seeds. And the first son was very happy. And he thought to himself, the youngest has destroyed the seeds. How can he return the same seeds? They've become plants. The second has also missed because he changed the seeds. They're no longer the same. And the second son thought, the first will miss because his seeds will be useless. They're rotten. They're dead. And the third has already missed because seeds are to be preserved. Exactly. Literally. So I'm going to win. And the third son never thought about winning. Father said the seeds are to be preserved. The only way to preserve a seed is to allow it to grow. Now the flowers have come. Soon seeds will be coming by the millions. And he was happy that his father would be happy. And then comes the inspection by the father. And he said to the first son, you're stupid. Seeds are not supposed to be preserved in a safety vault. A seed can be preserved only if it is allowed to die in the soil and thereby be reborn. And he said to the second son, you did better than the first, because at least you understand that seeds die. But a seed, if preserved, multiplies, and your quantity remains the same. You missed. And then he asked the third son, And he just took his father to the garden and said, I threw him in the ground. Seeds have become plants, and the plants are flowering. Soon there will be many seeds. If you want seeds, I will return them to you a millionfold. So the father made him the heir, his successor. What is this seed in you? How are you going to return it a millionfold? Now, we live, in a manner of speaking, we live an isolated existence. That is, we think we do. We have not yet maybe seen the vine of which we are the branches. So it is as if we are little rafts crossing the river of time, moving from the moment of birth to the moment of death, moving in time from one shore to another. And we have gathered in this span of life, however long, however short, we have gathered many things. Some correct, some incorrect, some of use, and some tremendously useless. But we have gathered these things, our toys, so much that the raft is almost sinking. And we can't leave the raft. We're in the middle of the river. And if we did leave it, we would have to leave our possessions. What you think, what you desire, what you have, what you hope to have, see? They all belong to one shore. You can't take them to the other shore. No one has ever been able to take anything from this so-called this world to the so-called other world, When you die, you can't take anything with you. You came alone, you're going to leave alone. So we hear this and we say, okay, I won't collect the commodities of the world. I will collect knowledge. Well, knowledge can't be carried over either. When this body is no more, the brain is no more. Where is this knowledge what hook is it going to hang on? Your knowledge, your accumulated information. Moving from the shore of ignorance to the shore of wisdom. So we find in this world three types of people. Those who collect things, those who collect knowledge, and then the third, those who accumulate awareness, who cultivate awareness, whose goal is to be more and more conscious. It is this consciousness, call it a seed if you will, it is this consciousness that moves from the shore of ignorance to the shore of wisdom. Both shores, both aspects, exist in us. There is the objective world and the subjective world. There is the phenomenal world and the noumenal world. There is the world of so-called matter and the world of consciousness or the world of spirit. Not two different worlds, two aspects of one world. But which of these do you cultivate? Why not both? One minute. When Pompeii was destroyed, you know, the volcano erupted and the whole city was on fire. The buildings fell, and here in the middle of the night, people scurrying around, trying to escape, everybody running, and everybody carrying something. Everybody carrying what they thought was their most precious possession. Gold or diamonds. The scholars had their books. Whatever, huh? But in the midst of all of this, here's this one man just poking along, you know, with his walking stick. And he didn't carry anything. And those who were carrying all their possessions felt for him. Maybe everything had already been destroyed in his house. See, their lives, as they had been accustomed to living, was being destroyed. Just as there are times in everybody's life when it seems like everything is wiped out. We save what we can. You know, so we can be secure, so we can have identification. Whatever, huh? But anyway, in Pompeii, here is this man now. He's walking out of the city as if he were on his morning walk. And they would stop and ask him, couldn't you save anything? Poor man, is everything lost? And the man simply said, well, I didn't have anything, you know. All I have, I'm carrying. See? What you're carrying is of this world. I have accumulated only awareness. It may be a crisis for you, but for me, it's time for my morning walk. Yeah? I thought it was kind of cute. You know, we in our culture have been accustomed to hiding from death. You know, don't talk to me about it. If people run from it, just let me ignore it. It's going to happen to me someday, but I'll ignore it until the time comes. Now, the attitude is slowly changing, you know. So we can look at it. It is a part of our lives. Yeah. Instead of hiding, you know, let's use some of our time as a preparation to be aware, even in death. Whatever you may be, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, huh? It doesn't make any difference, your position. The inner search is the same. The search for yourself, the search for pure awareness, to allow that which is within you to unfold. You know, we do this, you know, we sit for meditation. And one disciplines oneself very strongly in meditation. For it is said, meditation is a matter of life and death. And Jesus said, let him who seeks not cease seeking until he finds. And when he finds, he will be troubled. he will marvel. And he will reign over the all. And he said, whoever finds the explanation of these words will not taste death. A very peculiar situation we find ourselves in. We're looking for something, we're searching for something that we can't see and we can't touch. We don't know what God looks like. You don't know what God looks like. We don't know where we're going, even going inwardly into ourselves. But we do move within, and we grope within, and then something occurs, and it's puzzling, and you will be troubled. But you persist, and then something else occurs, and you will marvel at the magnificence and the dignity that is within you. You know, usually, those of you who have read books about this thing, mostly we read that when we find, we will be blissful. Oh, we're going to be so full of bliss and happiness, you know. Bliss comes when the crisis has settled. You know, first plant the seed. Allow it to die in its own way. Don't put your concepts on that. Then comes the flowering, and then comes the resurrection. The resurrection comes when the crisis is fully settled. Whoever finds the explanation of these words will not taste death. So don't worry about words. No more words. Words aren't going to help you. There is no word that I know of that's going to make you deathless. Maybe you know of a word that's going to make you deathless. Do you? What you're looking for is a living experience. See? One understands through experience, not through words. Whoever finds experience, whoever moves through this troubled state, you know, that St. John called the dark night, the spiritual night, who has been troubled, who has marveled, who has come to perceive what is called the mysterium. Mysterium. To come to see that my Father and I are one. How mysterious. This mystery that we live out, that we don't pay any attention to hardly. Now, when consciousness becomes aware of itself, there is a symbol that is used both in the Eastern and the Western culture. There is a symbol used to describe it, zero. Everything else is either plus or minus, positive or negative. This is zero. You know, at the beginning where I read that the spirit and the bride. So we have a spirit that is positive, and we say of it, and the bride that is negative, masculine and feminine. So they come together, and what do we have? Zero. See? In zero, there are no comparisons. There are no opposites. There are no relationships. It is zero. People not understanding this, you know, they look at it and say, well, you know, that's what the Buddhists say is nirvana, you know, zero. It's an extinction. It's blown out. It's all gone. You know, it's not true. You know, we name everything. We think we don't understand anything until we name it. See? But having named it, we think we know it. This is how our words fool us. See? All states of consciousness known to man have been named. Love. It's a name for something you can't see. Sweet is a name for something you can't describe. We personally, individually, may not know a certain state, but someone down the long corridors of the ages has known and has named it. We pick it up and say, we know. Sanskrit was written out of this. States of consciousness, you know. And zero is a state. It's not all gone. But all is extinguished except itself. Itself. And so Christ, dying on a cross, was not annihilated. He died, but he was deathless. Now, we look at the tremendous power of nature. But we look at it, I don't think we see it. We look at the creativity in this world. I don't know if you see it. No. Of course, now it's springtime, and the seeds are sprouting. They're blooming. And it is spoken of as the resurrection of nature. Its energy arousing from sleep, as it were. We live in an ebb and flow of creative energy. And within this ebb and flow, there steps out, you know, a living, sensate body. And being mine, I call it mine, you know. Something lives here that says mine. This body and this psyche is dependent upon consciousness. And then in this ebb and this flow, there comes a withdrawal. And we say, she died. Or we say, he died. And the body disintegrates. And the elements of that body return to the nature from which they were drawn. The first death. It's a first birth, physical birth, and a physical death, first death. And then the psyche continues for a while, maybe short time, maybe hundreds of years. There is now consciousness in the psychic world, in a psychic body. This does not represent the resurrection. In time, the consciousness withdraws from the psychic vehicle, and the elements of that body return to its source. That's the second death. No body, no psyche. What remains? Well, I've been telling you all along, consciousness. You could come out with that answer anyway. But with most, this consciousness has not known itself as itself. Consciousness is a label for something. It's a name for something. What is that something? We have not known it as a seed planted. You know, and not knowing, you know, after the second death, it returns to its source. Just as when we go to sleep at night. And in the morning, we're just the same as we were the night before. Resurrected every morning? Hardly. That's not the resurrection. So what is it? And now, in this world, there are many types of people. And there are many stages and many states in a moving toward this resurrectio, as the alchemists would say, huh? Some have very little desire to know anything about themselves. They seemingly have no need to understand themselves. Just let me have the TV and my six-pack and, you know, I've got it made, feet up on something. Almost. Then there are those who aspire somewhat, you know, and they dibble-dabble around with things. And then there are those in whom this yearning rises. It springs forth, you know, with this question, well, what is this life all about? What is this about? I wake up in the morning. How come? I go to sleep at night. Where do I go? Where do I come from? You know. And so they begin to mull around, and they begin to look. And there comes a time when this searching, these questions become a prime motivation. There is a hunger now. There is a need to know. You cultivate it, you know? Because out of this need, growth occurs. And this growth, words are not very good. Sometimes our expressions are not very good. But this, it pushes one as if it were toward the brink of an abyss. You know, toward this zero. See? And it is a soul-wrenching, soul-searching time. You know, and there's some tears in it. And there's work in it, discipline, you know. So there's some sweat in it. And you have to give up some things that you really like. So there's some agony in it. Yeah? And then there is also this need that gets to be so tremendous. You know, there is an agony, and it is that agony that is typified by the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, it seems strange to me at times, I have to throw this in, that Christianity stresses such anguish and sorrow. Jesus every once in a while does say, you know, to know my joy in its fullness. You know. But this kind of sorrow in Christianity, one doesn't find in Buddhism. One doesn't find it in Jainism. One doesn't find it in Hinduism. You know, Jesus walked the Via Doloroso, you know, sad. The Buddha sat under a tree. This is what that's what people have done with teachings. But anyway, in this final state of this agony of needing to know, you know, in the process, the transformation, it's the dark night of the soul, comes this final capitulation. First, we have this pleading, you know, oh, if it's possible, take this cup away from me. You know, I really don't want this, and I don't need this, and, you know, oh, if it's possible, let me know, but take this away from me. Until finally, you know, as thou wilt, as thou wilt, you know, this is then the total surrender, which is beyond our thinking. You cannot think surrender. And it is after that, then, you know, that the veil of the temple is rent, that the seed bursts. Yeah. So then 3 days later, and he had promised 3 days, 3 days later, Mary Magdalene comes to the tomb and she finds it empty. Now Mary, we could say, is a symbol of love. And she's looking for the man she loves, her beloved rabbi. And she is there in the garden, and two angels say to her, why seek ye the living among the dead? He is not here. He is risen. Woman, why weepest thou? And she answers, you know, and she says, well, because they have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him. And weeping, you know, she turns herself around. And that should weigh heavily with some of you. She turned herself around. And as she does, she perceives a figure standing whom she thinks to be the gardener. And this man speaks to her also. Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? And Mary, still not recognizing, said, sir, if thou hast borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. And very quietly, it's very early in the morning, and it's very silent in this garden. Now, this figure speaks again, and he says, Mary, you know, and the love that he has for this woman is in his voice. Mary, you know, and she hears this familiarity, you know, and something rises in her, something wakes up in her, and she looks at him and she says, oh Rabboni, you know, she recognizes the risen Christ. See, I am he that was dead, but now I live forevermore, the resurrectio. Our transformations, our everyday ones, and then the major ones, from objectively self-conscious in the race psyche to individual, and which is pure consciousness. And from individual then to the everlasting light. And then the tomb is empty. See? The seed has become what it was supposed to be. And whoever finds the explanation, whoever experiences what these words point to, shall not taste death. For now I live forevermore. forevermore. Okay. I hope you all have a wonderful Easter day. Yeah, all that it means. Make it mean something. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.